You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet here in my individual capacity. We're glad you're here. Now, I've been looking around YouTube and I noticed that in the 1980s, a Russian former KGB officer and defector, Yuri Bezmenov, gave an interview on Canadian television. And in his interview, Bezmenov discussed the KGB's strategy of ideological subversion against the West, whom the then Soviets could not conquer in a kinetic warfare. 15% of the time, money, and manpower, he said, is spent on traditional intelligence and espionage in the then Soviet Union, but the rest was a, quote, slow process of ideological subversion or psychological warfare, which is to change the perception of reality of every American to such an extent that despite their balance of information, as he called it, I think meaning a free and open press, no one is able to come to sensible conclusions in the interest of defending themselves, their families, and their community. He called it the great brainwashing process that goes very slow. So the question is, have we become brainwashed into disliking our country and each other? And does that render us so divided that we've become permanently vulnerable to autocracy? So my guest tonight is someone who thinks a lot about this, and that's an understatement. And I know that it's something she's thought about not just recently, but for years. Barb McQuaid is the author of Attack from Within, How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. Barb is a professor at the University of Michigan Law School. She's the former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, Detroit. And she's also former head of the National Security section in that office. But now you can find her on the Sisters-in-Law podcast, which you may have already heard, along with Joyce Vance. And who's the other person that does that with you, Barb? I'm blocking.
Jill Winebanks and Kimberly Atkins-Store.
Yes, it's fun. And they do talk very substantively. She's also on NBC News, and you may see her on MSNBC, where she is a legal analyst. But that's not all, because she has some sort of overachieving gene. She is also the mother of four kids. And speaking from experience, if you have to be stuck in an elevator with someone for, I don't know, 2 hours, Barb is a pretty good person to be stuck there with. Barb, I'm glad to see you.
Yeah, I'm glad to see you too, Lisa, and not in an elevator. You know, although yes, you also were a good person to be stuck in an elevator with, I'm really glad that you may remember the third person who was in the elevator, and that was a court security officer who had a walkie-talkie and was able to communicate with the outside so that people knew we were in there. That was the one that gave me the
most. That was big. I can't remember the walkie-talkie working, but I know my cell phone wasn't. I know I had to reschedule my flight from Detroit. But I will tell you, sort of apropos of what we're going to talk about, one of the features of my visit with you was I got to see downtown Detroit. It was being restored to its once splendor with a lot of interesting architecture and buildings. But it also struck me what has happened to our country in terms of the loss of manufacturing, sort of the disenfranchisement of whole swaths of people, and what's happened to some of our great cities as things move offshore and change the way we see ourselves. But I want to get to your book because obviously you're a rock star. You've been talking about this book now for a year because everyone wants to talk about it. One of the premises of your book is that disinformation is really leading us to the point where we're vulnerable to autocracy that could destroy democracy and our core democratic values. Do you think that's fair to say? And let's talk about sort of what people have done on their own to bring themselves to this point.
Yes, that is one of the theories of the book. There are people who are using disinformation to advance their own political agenda. And even though the tactics may be the same that we saw from other authoritarians in history, you know, Hitler and Mussolini and others, I think the thing that puts it into hyperdrive today is technology, the ability to use 24/7 cable, the ability to use social media, the ability to use artificial intelligence to really supercharge some of these false claims, I think is one of the things that makes it so difficult for people to be able to keep up with the news, feel like they have an understanding. You know, some of the same things you just talked about the interview by Yuri Bezmenov about destabilizing people in this slow subversion process, I think is absolutely going on today. And I think one of the things, one of the techniques that disinformers use is an effort to divide and conquer us into different camps, to sow discord in society. It's something that we found Russia was doing to us in the 2016 election. And now I think that there are American politicians who also use some of these techniques to try to divide and conquer us so that we care more about the success of our team than about any other issue. And as a result, we find people voting against their own economic self-interest because what they care more about is the victory of their team. Winning is what matters. And so people are choosing their political tribe over truth. And I think that's a very dangerous place to be in a democracy.
In your response, you hit on something which is a key feature of any sort of authoritarian overtake of an otherwise somewhat democratic system is the vilification of the other, the dehumanizing of the other. But this has kind of been a feature of American life, I'm sad to say, for a very long time. You know, there have been racial divides in this country, even the suffragists, that they were vilified as wild, radical, dangerous women. But this has been a pattern in the United States that goes back to our founding. You quote in your book, Sun Tzu's Art of War, which I think is a good go-to for everybody. And frankly, I don't think anybody should be a functioning person in society and not have read it. But this was one of his, they call them sage statements, that the best thing to do is to divide a population. But let's talk about what structural changes that we can do to begin to sort of turn this around. And let's also talk about how we got to this point. We used to communicate with each other. We used to have a lingua franca. We had linear television, three networks. News was on at 6:30 to 7 every night. We sort of had a collective knowledge of what was real. We had papers, although I will point out, they've often and for years been owned by very rich people, including Hearst Publications and others. But we had an understanding of what the truth was that we shared. We also had editorial oversight of news. I don't know. What do you think? I feel like it's a free-for-all.
Yeah. You know, some of the structural change, I'm not sure is necessarily a bad thing. You know, we had these gatekeepers run primarily by white male establishment figures who told us what was important news and what was not. You know, we didn't hear about the womanizing of JFK because the boys in the club didn't think that that was something we needed to share with America. I think people today might disagree with that. But I think the one thing we did have that was so important that we're missing today was fact-checking of news and gatekeepers. You know, there was a time, I think as late as the 1970s, that the LA Times had something like 50 reporters at their Washington, D.C. bureau. The news was rigorously reported and fact-checked and presented to the American people. And today, of course, anybody can be a journalist. We have bloggers and Substackers, and some are very good and some are not so good. We have podcasters with no real oversight, with no editors, with nobody exercising editorial discretion to decide what ends up in that publication. And so as a result, we're very fractured, and we have people who rely on news that is not accurate. And so that creates these different impressions of what exists in the world. And if we can't even agree on what the baseline facts are, then it's impossible to agree on how to solve our problems together. So we've got these, you know, echo chambers all around our country of people who watch one channel or another, who get all their news from social media. And of course, that is self-selected of your friends and followers and the things they like and share. And so instead of seeing all of the news that is fit to print, as they used to say, instead, all we see is the news shared with us by our friends. And so I think as a result of that, you're right that we are very splintered, and it makes it difficult for all of us to get our arms around what is the important news of the day that we should be discussing and debating to make better policy choices.
Well, I find increasingly when I talk to my friends, a lot of them are looking to news that is, I guess, partially state edited and controlled. And I'll give you an example. I think a large number of people in Washington, D.C. now listen to the BBC, which is the British broadcast system. Also, France 24 English, which is France 24 English, is available here in Washington. There's a lot of consuming of that, along with I read the Financial Times. But it is to the point that I don't enjoy, and I try to keep out of my feed news on social media because I understand the algorithm is going to, whatever I show an interest in, they'll publish something more extreme and more weird until I'm getting things that are conspiracy theory based, maybe consistent with some of the theories that I have, but not based on any facts. You talked about the newspapers. We had Chris Steyer-Walt, who was the author of Broken News, on our podcast a few years back. And he concluded that the loss of local newspapers and really the loss of linear television was what really heralded the push into separate camps. And he cited the advent of all things of Craigslist, which he felt like bankrupted local newspapers who depended on classified ads, as they were called back then, for revenue. And that's when the massive layoffs began and papers began shuttering. Have you thought at all about how we fix this? I know that the Wall Street Journal has been covering efforts by some business people to reinvigorate local newspapers. It's not going well. And what other solutions we might come up with to draw people away from this sort of dopamine addicting social media and back to critical thinking, real fact consumption?
Yeah, I think the loss of local news is contributing to the problem. So I completely agree with Chris Steyer-Walt. There's another great book called Saving the News by Martha Minow, who's a First Amendment scholar at Harvard University. She writes about this problem as well, and refers to areas without local newspapers as news deserts. And there are a lot of places around the country. And this contributes to several problems. One is that there's nobody covering the local city council meeting. It may even be nobody's covering the state budget meeting or the state budget process or the local road commission or the school board. Or maybe there's some, you know, local blogger with an axe to grind who is reporting on it. So you're not getting accurate information. You may be getting some reporting with someone with an axe to grind, but you're not finding out about issues that matter in your own community. When you don't have information, our minds will fill in the vacuum and we will ascribe to people the worst motives and the worst conspiracy theories you can imagine. You know, the reason that this building is coming down, I heard, is so that, you know, some millionaire can recoup losses on something. So it leads to distrust in the public when we don't have full information about how our local government is working. I think the other thing it does is it has caused this nationalization of the news. If you think back to 10 years ago, you were discussing issues going on nationally, but you were also discussing issues occurring in your local community. You know, here in Michigan, where I live, we would talk about state politics. We would talk about what's happening in the city of Detroit. We would talk about things that are happening where I live here in Ann Arbor. And those things occupied equal parts of our attention. And because they were local, we felt more empowered to affect change. With this new obsession with national news, where we feel far more removed from it, we feel like we lack power to affect change. We just read about all these things that are happening to us instead of feeling like this is part of our community where we have the ability to make a difference. So that's a problem with the dearth of local news. And the last one is, I think we miss out on one of the great attributes of local newspapers, which is their ability to build community. When we read in local newspapers, we know about the art fair that's occurring in our community and we're more likely to go. We might read about the kid who won the science fair and that builds local pride. We might learn about the local lacrosse championship and it gives us something to talk about at the corner bakery. So all of those things contribute to building community and building pride and connections between people. So I think that loss of local journalism is really hurting. I don't know what the solution is, but I think that there are things we can do. You know, government subsidies are a little difficult because you don't want the government directing what newspapers are covering. But there are some models that have been successful. Cal Matters is a local news outlet in California that focuses on statewide issues in California that's all funded by private donations. Same with the Texas Tribune, focuses on issues of national and local importance, all funded by local funds. And I'm also aware from some of the work I'm doing in Michigan that there are nonprofit foundations that have recognized this need for local journalism and are beginning to fund particular positions at newspapers. So, for example, there's a group in Detroit that funds positions with the Detroit Free Press to talk about issues on public health, because that is an issue of particular concern. So that's a different funding model. But I think we need to really get creative and explore ways, because you're right, in the advent of the internet and Craigslist, we don't have the model anymore where businesses are supporting the model. We've got subscriptions for the New York Times and the Washington Post and other publications, but it's difficult for smaller papers to succeed with that model when their number of subscribers aren't at that same kind of scale that we see with those national publications.
Another aspect of this, though, in my opinion, Barb, and feel free to shoot this down, I think we have a loss of civic engagement in part because people aren't going to church anymore, or it doesn't have to be church, synagogue, anything. The JCs or wherever they used to meet, yeah. I think they're together when their kids are in school. And then when they're gone, I think these points of confluence have fractured. I do think a part of this has been some of the scandals around perhaps the Catholic Church and other churches where there have been, the public has learned that there's been some bad behavior, criminal behavior or victimization. And, you know, maybe those less institutions are less attractive now. But I don't see physical points of confluence. And one of the things that I see in the data is twofold. And this is, I'm parroting what I've heard from social scientists at NYU. And the first thing is that the older you are and the more rural, the more what they call susceptible to influence. In other words, susceptible to false messaging you are. The less civic ties you have, the more susceptible to influence, meaning the more susceptible to false messaging you are. And what they're finding is that people have retreated into their homes and they feel that the connection is occurring on the internet. And this has become a source of false news and vilification of the other that you talk about. And in chapter 9 of your book, which is the solutions focused chapter, you really focus on the algorithms. And I think we've all gotten to a point where we get what you're saying. I don't think that everybody, when this book first came out, yeah. I'm not sure people got this.
Yeah. People are getting more savvy about these things.
Yeah. And then it went to the Supreme Court. And you remember that discourse over Section 230, which yeah. I frequently call 203 or 213. But you had conversations about, well, how is this different from Etsy? And I believe that was Sotomayor said that. Thomas asked, how is it that this is different from getting more recipes of this kind of food? What do you think about this at this point with respect to the algorithm? I feel if we don't find a way to control the algorithm, it controls us.
So first, let me say about our withdrawal from civic institutions, 100% agree with that. In fact, there's a book from the year 2000, Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone, very popular book, who raised it, you know, 25 years ago, that this was already becoming a problem, that people were not joining things anymore. And his theory was it was too comfortable to stay home and watch television. And that was why people were not going out and joining bowling leagues anymore or JCs or other things. But I think you're right that the problem has only become worse because 25 years later, we don't just have television to keep us at home. We have the internet. We have people working more from home. A pandemic certainly caused us to retreat from some of the activities we participated in. As you said, we have fewer people who are participating in faith communities, in labor unions, in civic organizations like Rotary Clubs and Kiwanis Clubs and other kinds of things. Those are the kinds of places where we meet people across difference. When we spend our time on social media, we are surrounded by people who are like-minded, telling us we're right and all those other people are wrong and bad, and not just bad, but demons who hate America. When we meet people across difference, I think we are more inclined to see that we have more in common than we have difference, you know, that we may be of different races, we may be of different religions, we may be of different working classes, we may be of different political parties. But you know what? Joe loves his kids too, just the same way I do. And we all care about health and peace and prosperity and all of those kinds of things that everybody cares about. So trying to rebuild and invest in civic institutions could be a really important way for all of us to get past this moment. I think it's certainly one part of the solution. But your question about Section 230, I know there has been a movement to repeal it. As you say, the Communications Decency Act of 1996 gave immunity to internet service providers from legal liability. And that creates some problems today because people who run Meta, Facebook, X, Instagram, all of these platforms cannot be sued for the content that is on there, no matter how false or harmful it may be. I have to find the sender. So if you post something defamatory about me on Facebook, I can sue you, but I can't sue Facebook. But most often, the people who are posting defamatory things about me are not people I know or can identify. They're people with names like Patriot Girl 1776. And I don't know who that is. And the server comes back to Russia and I can't find anybody to sue. So there's no one for me to sue. And I'm left without a remedy. And so I think that in 1996, it made a lot of sense to have immunity from legal liability for internet service providers. I mean, think about where you were in 1996. Where were you working, Elisa? Were you working? Were you in law school? Where were you in 1996?
I'm trying to remember. You know, that feels so ancient ago, but I think I was working as a civil rights attorney at that time.
All right. And I know I was working in private practice. Did you have email there? We didn't.
We had some version of it, but we didn't use it.
Internal only.
Yeah, we didn't use it. I can tell you we did not use it.
And did you imagine the existence of anything like Meta or X, where you could post messages that could beam all over the world?
Yeah, I will tell you that by that time, yes. So I am the daughter of a scientist and the sister of a scientist. And so we had already accessed what we could that was available. And we were, you know, connecting to the internet. And we were communicating with each other at that time, number one. Number two, it seemed apparent to me, living as I did at that time in Los Angeles in the film industry, that I noticed a trend in terms of entertainment. And one of the things that I did with some regularity with my friends is I would go to these festivals on shorts, they were called. And they would be films that were 20 minutes or less, and some were as little as 2 or 3 minutes. They were almost like television ads of some kind or internet ads. And I saw that there were more and more people coming to these events and enjoying this stuff that I thought a lot of it wasn't very substantive. And a lot of it appeared to be organically created by people as opposed to by some production company.
Yeah.
So I guess I could have imagined it on this scale. Absolutely not. But I also was a fan of science fiction, and I feared like the Soma from Brave New World. And I always thought that like some big corporation or some controlling entity would try to distract us with some chemical inducing effort that I felt would really dumb down critical thinking, you know, the appetite for challenging. I was a dark young person. That's all I can tell you. Very dark.
Well, your imagination was pretty accurate. I mean, it may not be chemical unless you count dopamine with the jolt we get when we look at social media. But I could not have imagined in 1996 that we would have anything like we have today with social media, a little computer that I carry around in my pocket, and the ability to reach anybody anywhere in the world to read content that people had made. And amazing. It's been an incredible innovation and a wonderful invention that does some really remarkable things. But in 1996, the goal was to foster innovation, to encourage investment, because we wanted to see what people could do if they were freed from the fear of legal liability. And that's why
we did it, in fairness, right? I mean, there haven't really, until TikTok, I guess, there haven't really been other countries that have developed major internet powerhouses, major internet service providers. It's been the bigs, you know, and emerging from that, your point about regulation stymieing growth, which it was the belief, I think, at the time. I'm certainly some of the hearings would have suggested that they believe that. The saying now that one of the reasons why the ISPs are always being challenged in Europe is, you know, the United States innovates, but Europe regulates. And now that was sort of an ugly thing. Like, wow, they're going to stymie the growth of something that could provide tremendous boost to the economy of any individual country. But to your point, right, I think everybody thought this was without cost.
Yeah, I don't think we need to think in all or nothing terms, right? I think that there are lots of room for compromise in all of this. But, you know, the idea that we're going to take something that was created in 1996 and use the same rules we used in 1996 to adjust to what we have today is just a poor fit. You know, imagine it's like raising a baby alligator in your bathtub, right? It's adorable while it's still small and harmless, but at some point it grows into a man-eating predator and you need to change the way you take care of it. I think we have created a man-eating predator with social media and the quaint little rules we had in 1996 that succeeded in fostering innovation and investment have worked, and now is the time to adjust those rules. Now, this bill that's been introduced by congressional Democrats would repeal Section 230. I don't know that I would completely repeal it, because the idea is if you run a social media platform and you're responsible for the millions and millions of messages there all day, it might make the barriers to entry too great for competitors. And I think it would be great to have competitors. In fact, I think we could use the antitrust laws to maybe break up some of these enormous social media platforms. But some of the things I would propose is that we amend Section 230 to continue to allow legal liability, immunity from legal liability, for the most part, but with some exceptions, with some conditions. One of the conditions is you will be regulated by a federal agency. Maybe it's the FTC, maybe it's some other agency. And when you think about the idea that the internet is unregulated, a critical information infrastructure, it really seems kind of insane, doesn't it? I mean, think about other industries. Every invention we've had throughout history has brought with it incredible innovation and value, and also some negative collateral consequences. I mean, look at the airplane. The Wright brothers invent the airplane. It enables airline travel all over the world eventually, right? A wonderful thing that we all enjoy. But to invent the airplane is also to invent the plane crash. And so what have we done to reduce the risk of plane crashes? We regulate the industry. There are all kinds of regulations on how you design airplanes, how you build them, how you fly them. We have air traffic controllers to make sure the paths are clear. We have pilots who receive training and certifications and rules about how long they can fly before they have to rest. All of those regulations were put in place to protect the public. And when it comes to information infrastructure, we have nothing. And so, you know, it's still in its infancy, but I think that the time has come to have some modest regulations. For example, having regulators that oversee the algorithms that tell us what content rises to the level that we see and what other content gets demoted. Maybe that doesn't have to be shared publicly, but maybe regulators get to inspect those algorithms and make sure they are not being set to promote outrage as we know they currently are because of the congressional testimony of a Facebook whistleblower. Maybe we also can have regulation that tells social media companies what they can and cannot do with our private data, that they scrape and then sell to data brokers that in turn sell it to private entities or sell it to political operatives, that they then turn around against us and micro-target us with ads. And so I think some of these modest changes, not talking about regulating content whatsoever, which could have problems with the First Amendment, but regulating some of these processes that the social media companies themselves create, I think that would be a place that we should start in tweaking Section 230.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.